When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Okay, motherfucker!
What are you looking at, sir?
I'm looking at you, miss.
Run that, baby.
I'm not the Zodiac. And if I was, I certainly wouldn't tell you.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Parallax Views, a very special bonus episode of the Parallax Views. It is nearly the 50th anniversary of Alan J. Pakula's 1974 American paranoia masterpiece, The Parallax View. And I'm here today joined by a friend, one of my favorite critics on anything on your screen, an independent bookstore owner, an author, and the editor-at-large, RogerEbert.com. It's my friend, Matt Zolozites. How are you, sir?
Hey, Blake.
On June 29th, at the Texas Theater, Matt Zolozites and filmmaker Sam Esmail are doing a special Q&A about their love of The Parallax View. Before Matt and I dive in, here's a little snippet, a little taste of what you're going to be able to see in conversation with Matt and Sam on June 29th in the Texas Theater.
In the way, you know what I kind of liken it to? I always say, like, Hitchcock, what he did with Fear and Suspense is what I think Pakula just does with paranoia.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I think if he's the master of suspense, Pakula's the master of paranoia. And that's what if Pakula had allowed us to grieve in those moments, I think it would have taken it away. I think it's all kind of fed into the tone of the film and kind of how brutal and full it was.
Well, I would take this even perhaps one step further and say that The Parallax View is a film that takes on the attitude of its unseen villains. Like, I feel like we're seeing, like, this is a very cold, methodical, forget about unsentimental, it's unemotional world where, you know, people who are enemies or who are in the way are killed. They're eliminated. They're eliminated from their lives, and they're eliminated from the story that we are witnessing. And the movie begins with, establishing this event that has to be covered up. And then we get the findings of the, you know, basically their version of the Warren Commission. And I feel like we're, in a way, it's almost like we're reading a report or we're seeing some kind of legal presentation. Like, it really is just the facts, and there's no time to grieve, no time to feel. And like that cut from Paula Prentice basically essentially saying, I know what's going on. I know it's the truth. Why won't you believe me, to her dead on a slab, is the perfect way to communicate that. And, you know, and every death, you know, we're in a way, in retrospect, it seems obvious that it has to end with Warren Beatty's character dying.
It really does.
And because it's systematically eliminating all of the people who are not only firsthand witnesses to the killing, but who are with anybody who survived it.
What compelled you to go and do this? Because I know that you do a great series of screens. You've done some in New York. You've done them on Zodiac, for one was a big one. Megan Abbott, I remember. What was it, just the anniversary coming up, or is there another special connection that you have, particularly with Parallax?
Well, it was mainly the anniversary coming up. I knew that it was released in 1974, and I looked up the date, and it was, we didn't get it exactly to the day, but we did get to the month. And, I wanted to do something for the 50th because that's obviously a big milestone,
a big
sort
one.
Of anniversary. But also, I just love the movie. It's one of my favorite films of all time. And I made a list one time years and years ago of my favorite films of all time. And A startlingly high proportion of them were what you would call depressing or disturbing. And people asked about that, like they were inquiring about my mental health. And I was like, no, it really doesn't have anything to do with that to me. It's just like, I don't really think of an ending as being a happy ending or a sad ending. I only think, is the ending correct for the movie or is it compromised in some way?
Yes.
And most endings are compromised in some way. They tell you what you want to hear as opposed to what they actually probably believe in their hearts, or that they know you probably believe.
Yeah.
You know, most romantic comedies are guilty of this. And I always think of that great Orson Welles quote, and I'm paraphrasing, but you know, the difference between a happy ending and a sad ending is where you choose to end the story. And,
yes.
You know, and really, like, any happy ending would be a sad ending if you fast forward, you know, a few decades to the key participants dying of perfectly ordinary diseases in old age, you know. But, you know, that's all neither here nor there. The point is, Parallax View is one of the most dark, disturbing, depressing films probably ever made in the studio system in this country. And it's a perfect film. And I love it. The filmmaking is extraordinary. The performances, the writing, the cinematography, we're going to talk about all of that, but just like it's a perfect object. And it's my favorite of Pakula's films. And I think it's pure. It's pure. It's, you know, greater than Clute, greater than All the President's Men. Presumed Innocent, another Pakula film I like a lot, greater than that. He never, like, it is to his filmography as I think The Conversation or The Original Godfather are to Coppola's, you know, or Taxi Driver is to Scorsese. Like, you can make arguments about, are there other films in their filmographies that are as great or greater, but I think it would be hard to argue that there are ones that are more perfect, like,
yeah,
every single piece, every element pulling its weight, and it's just remarkable.
I love what you said about purity of filmmakers, because that's a really interesting thing, is because I agree Parallax is its purest, and like the conversation is so pure. It's so pure. It's just like even Danny Boyle's Shallow Grave, like it's just pure,
yeah.
Like Coen Brothers' Blood Simple, pure. Like you are mainlining those filmmakers. And I think that this, for Pakula's like interest in psychoanalysis and not necessarily being a guy, even though he was like steeped in the Hollywood system, loved narrative cinema, finally kind of unbridled himself to get a little bit more sort of psychedelic in a way, as much as he could. Paranoia is obviously all about that internal dialogue, but him being completely uninhibited by the time he gets to Parallax, I think that that's just like, you're so right about that. And it's just gorgeous. It's the set pieces are unbelievable. In my last couple of conversations here about Parallax, I've been talking to folk and prescribing what I think their favorite scene is. And knowing you a bit, if I had to pick what I think your favorite scenes are, because I know that you love orchestration of elements and feeling, mm-hmm. I would have to say the bookends of the movie, the beginning and ends, the way this movie starts on the tower, the assassination, the fallout, and then particularly just the build up to that finale, this incredible sort of political rally thing, the rehearsal. I would have to say they would be your favorite moments. If I was prescribing as your friend, knowing what you love, I'd be like, they're kind of Matt's deal. There's so much going on. They're so rich. He would just pour over them and love them over and over again. Am I close?
It's a perfect movie that, you know, for like characters, you know, specifically the lead character. I love movies where characters are hoist on their own petard, as the bard would put it. And this is a great movie where that happens. And it's horrible and wonderful.
There is such a kind of magical assemblage of different like generic conventions in this too. I remember pouring over this movie, I love watching the more sort of what becomes the like canonical like imagery of paranoia cinema in American filmmaking, you know, all these stark, harsh angles and, you know, slow pursuits up escalators and going into these impenetrable steel buildings, you know, steel and glass buildings and things like that.
Yeah.
But I also love that there's like a bar fight and a car chase. And like, it, like in the movie, it just like has a car. It suddenly turns into a car chase movie. And then it's got a breakup movie in there. And then it's got like an old timey, you know, you being the sort of main acolyte of Deadwood. It's got like a Howard Hawks cowboy bar fight in this movie as well. I just love that it has these things, these elements where you're like, oh, now we're in a bar fight Western. It's beautiful. I'd love to talk to you about like the way that these kind of weird and wonderful generic conventions as the story carries along just sort of pop up and you're suddenly in a different movie for 10 minutes.
Well, you know, for starters, let's just establish here that we're going to talk about the entire movie. I think anybody who listens to your podcast knows that we eat every part of the buffalo, as it were. So if you haven't seen the movie before, you shouldn't be listening to this. And you've been warned. We're going to talk about everything that happens in the movie. So Warren Beatty plays Joe Frady, who's this investigative reporter, and I believe that in a previous draft of the script he was a cop. But he's an investigative reporter, and he is a kind of a self-destructive, has a problem with authority, maverick, risk-taking, hot-tempered, drinks too much, kind of your classic hero of the 70s, 80s and beyond. You know, the sort of person who, I think if this movie were made in the 90s, he would have been probably played by somebody like Bruce Willis.
For sure.
You know, and Clint Eastwood has played versions of this character many, many times as well. And there's a darkness to this guy. And he was present for an assassination that is modeled on many of the assassinations from the 60s. And it happens at in the Space Needle. It's very similar to Robert F. Kennedy's assassination in a lot of particulars. And what happens is the witnesses, the firsthand witnesses to this event, are dying. They're dying off. And Joe kind of throws himself into this mystery. One of his close friends, played by Paula Prentice, warns him of what's going on, and he doesn't take her seriously. And this is one of the greatest cuts in the entire history of cinema. It cuts to her on the slab in the morgue. I hate to say it, but it's funny. It's horribly, horribly funny in that sort of Hitchcockian way. And in fact, Reverse Shot, the film magazine, wrote a great essay many years ago about that in a special issue about edits. Just individual edits. And that is one of the best ones in the entire history of American cinema. And it's so economical. And it's funny because it is so abrupt.
Yes.
But they kind of put Joe in this position of being like the classic rebel who won't play by the rules and is going to get to the bottom of it and doesn't listen to anybody and goes with his gut and all this kind of, all these sorts of cliches. But you start to realize as the movie goes on that this is a movie, one of these rare American studio pictures that is a parody or a subversion or a critique of that type of mentality. And I would put it right up there with To Live and Die in L.A., William L. Peterson's character in To Live and Die in L.A., where, you know, he pays the ultimate price for being this sort of typical cliche cowboy cop sort of person. And I also think, you know, there's something about this movie that reminds me of The Vanishing.
Yeah.
The original Vanishing. And you know, talk about a movie that has an ending that is not a happy ending by any stretch. It's about the worst ending you could possibly have if you have that kind of story. But it is perfect. It is the right ending for that. And it's very similar. Like, I would do a double feature of The Parallax View and The Original Vanishing if I didn't want to be... You know, except that I don't want to be liable for mental health problems that it would cause in people who sat through.
I just want to say, in LA, they do a fantastic thing, which I'm always very I look on very admirably, is Bleak Week. They embrace a week of bleak films together, and everyone sort of gathers around. You know, there's films like I think the other night it was Destroyer and Seven, and there was a couple of other films that were all just rolling together, and people embraced the bleak. And so I think, you know, there's definitely room. If people are listening out there for a bleak week, Matt Zolicide's double of The Parallax View and The Vanishing. I mean, that's as bleak as it gets, Matt. That's great. And I know you are a fan of his, and I know that your store stocks his books, but Adam Neyman, great author, great writer, was talking to me about Chinatown, and he was like, it was like when Roman Polanski looked at the script for Chinatown with Robert Towne and put together agonizingly over many years, and then just made the ending unimaginably more awful.
Yes.
Because that was right. It was, it suited it. I feel like in that, when you're talking about it, the ending is so pure because it's so unimaginably awful. And it's like, but it's perfect. It's perfect in that regard. So
not, I would say the only part of that I would take issue with is the word unimaginably.
Yeah, true.
You know, we can actually imagine it all too well.
Yes.
You know, by that point, you know, there had been, you know, the assassination of John F. Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, and a lot of other people, and a lot of attempted assassinations and bombings and conspiracies. And there was a war going on that a lot of the population was opposed to, and that was killing American citizens, you know, by the bushel. And Vietnamese citizens in the hundreds of thousands, and it didn't see, and it finally ended, I guess, when the powers that be decided they felt like ending it, you know, and it was just such a dark, such a cynical, despairing sort of time. And I think this, you know, this movie really like takes the cake. I mean, in terms of representations of the mentality of that period in time, and you know, that was my childhood. That was my early childhood, the 70s. And I remember feeling that heaviness. And, you know, growing up in a world where movies were, you know, the movies that were playing were things like The Godfather and, you know, The Conversation and Parallax View and Chinatown and all these movies that were, you know, I was too young for them. I couldn't get in to see them. They eventually showed up on television, but like, you know, The Exorcist in a way.
Yeah. The most horrific thing in The Exorcist that I tell people all the time, I'm just like, watch a mother desperately pleading for help and a chorus of medical professionals ignore her. I go, that might be one of the darkest. I go, that might be the darkest scene in the movie, in a movie that is as bleak as it gets, as horrifying as it gets. I'm like, just her pleading for help and them not listening. That continues to chill me. And I know you're a dad too, but as a dad of two littlies, I'm like, that chills me to my bones these days when I revisit The Exorcist.
Oh, totally, totally. And, you know, it's also just like that Leonard Cohen song, Everybody Knows. Like, everybody knows the dice are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guys lost. Everybody knows the fight was fixed. The poor stay poor. The rich get rich. That's how it goes. Everybody knows. Yeah. You know, that's the Parallax View.
Everybody knows that the dice are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guys lost. Everybody knows the fight was fixed. The poor stay poor, the rich get rich. That's how it goes. Everybody knows.
It leads to a scene in Parallax, which I just think is so magnificent, which is as Joe Frady, Warren Beatty's character, is traveling through, and you can see that his gut instinct is so off. We were talking about he has this gut instinct. It would be more traditionally played. He'd be more on point. He'd be accelerating his investigation. And all we see him do in this movie is dig himself further into a quagmire that he doesn't understand. And one of my favorite moments is He goes to like a hospital and visits a doctor where he's in a room and they're explaining to him about what it can take to sort of create these sleeper agents, what it can take to manipulate people. And I think it's just, it's one of the most magnificent scenes in this movie and so fun to rewatch even in isolation over and over again. It's because that whole, exactly as you said, despite the fact that it's working with these cliches and it's being a satire of these cliches, there are certain things that come in and they just like, you can feel like it's capturing that same energy of like an Oliver Stone's JFK, where like someone is in the middle of the movie talking about sleeper agents and talking about plants and talking about how they can manipulate people. And it has almost too much like resonance. You just look at it and you're like, yeah, this could happen. This is something. What is, and the reality in those little moments in this movie, I think, strike through and hit you in different ways. And then the movie continues as it does to be this beautifully orchestrated thing. But I also think that each scene, the weight of each scene and the resonance of each scene, particularly that scene, has a cut through in Parallax that's so hard to like manufacture. It's just like it becomes alchemical after a while, and you're like, this is just doing things on a level and a frequency that so many other movies just can't even touch.
Yeah, it is. And it's also a movie that has it contains scenes and sequences that you've seen before, but in my opinion, done better than anyone has ever done them. In some cases, it's just the sheer power of Pakula's directing and Gordon Willis's cinematography, and Beatty's performance, and the screenplay by Lorenzo Semple Jr., who kind of broke through on the original Batman.
He did
the remake of King Kong, the 76 version, so he had a counterculture kind of sensibility. And David Giler, who of course, you know, co-founded Brandywine Films with Walter Hill, worked on the Alien films among many other movies. And so, you know, this is an incredible collection of talent brought to bear on this one film, and everybody's on the same page. And you know, I love that it tricks you in the way that I think Joe is tricked.
Yes.
Like it lulls you in, like you think you know everything, you think you know what you're getting into, and you don't. And you find out only at the very end that you were out of your element, Donnie, as they say in Big Lebowski. You're out of your element. And that moment where this guy who's basically kind of a, I don't know if he's a recruiter or an evaluator or what, goes over to this cold water flat that Joe Frady, you know, as an undercover guy is living in. And it's really amazing because, like, you watch it again, every time you watch it, it becomes, you sort of see all these other layers to it. But he's giving a performance. Joe Frady, you know, Warren Beatty is giving a performance as Joe Frady, giving a performance as the type of person that he believes that the Parallax Corporation would recruit to be an assassin. And in my opinion, the guy that is in the scene with him is looking at him and seeing through all of it.
Oh, absolutely.
I think he's seeing through all of it. And I think what he's seeing is like, okay, he's actually going, okay, this guy is the perfect recruit, not to be an assassin, to be a patsy.
Yes.
And that's where it ends up, is like at the end. And that look on Beatty's face right before the gun, you know, the gun goes off and kills him, is, you know, I swear to God, is, you know, his expression is like, oh my God, I'm the patsy. That's what it looks like the scene in Speed when Jeff Daniels' character bursts into the house thinking Dennis Hopper's going to be there, and he isn't. And there's that close-up of his face right before the bomb goes off. And I always think that close-up of him is going, oh my God, I'm the sidekick. You know?
It's perfect.
Just great. And it's just so perfect. But then the other thing is, in the middle of this movie that would be a masterpiece under any circumstances, by any yardstick, there's a sequence that is one of the greatest sequences in the entire history of cinema, any country, any era, which is the montage.
Yeah.
Where he goes into the Parallax Corporation and he sits down in this chair and he's shown this series of images, which is like not only a great, a very convincing in my opinion, as a montage of a sort that I think would actually be shown to somebody under these circumstances. I 100% believe it. And it's also just a great commentary on what editing is.
Yeah.
And this idea of like, it's the Kuleshov effect, you know, but it's stretched out to 4 minutes and it's got a really cool soundtrack to it. But it's like, you know, you see the same images over and over again, but they're arranged differently. They're juxtaposed against different things. Like the order is reshuffled and the meaning changes depending on where images are placed. And you know, so you see images of Nazis, for example, and other authoritarian figures that are initially associated with being scary, being undesirable. And then later, it seems like they're supposed to be attractive.
Yes.
You know, the way they're positioned, and the idea of, you know, Thor, the mighty Thor, seemingly being associated with, I think, joy, innocence, kind of a childlike feeling of euphoria. And then this kind of twisted power fantasy. And of course, it makes me think about, you know, the kind of comic book obsessive incels, you know, who if you write a negative review of a Batman movie, they believe homophobic slurs in the comments, like that kind of mentality.
Yes.
It like seems to look forward, you know, 40 or 50 years to when that would be common. And also sometimes they'll crop an image, like they'll show you an image and then they'll reframe it.
And then they hyper-focus, yeah, and reframe one specific part of the frame.
And there's one example that I just think is absolutely brilliant, which is there's a shot. I don't know what it is. I think it's an archival photo probably, but you see this little boy who's naked and he's running away from the camera. It's black and white photo. He's absolutely seems to be in sheer terror. And in the foreground, there is an adult man seemingly chasing after him. And this guy's belt is fastened in such a way that the end of the belt is jutting out. And you don't think a thing about it when you see the wide shot, but later when they return to the image, they crop in to a super tight close-up of the end of that belt, and it looks like phallic.
Yes.
And you think, and the whole time, like as they're showing you this stuff, you're thinking, what am I supposed to be feeling? What am I supposed to be reading here? And yeah, and like what reactions is it supposed to elicit? And I would imagine, you know, and they don't tell you, but I would imagine like when you get to that point in the montage, maybe that's supposed to be like if the person sitting in that chair was a victim of sexual violence as a child, that they would feel that blast of emotion from them sitting in that chair, and they would know, oh, this is another way to manipulate them to get what we want out of them or something. But also, like I keep saying, I guess or I think they don't tell you
that. No,
they don't tell you.
It's not prescribed. And, you know,
it's always compared to the Ludovico technique sequence in A Clockwork Orange, but I think it's greater. I think it's greater than that. I mean, it couldn't exist probably without Kubrick doing a version of it first, but it's greater because they don't show you reaction shots of Beatty. And apparently there was pressure to show reaction shots of Beatty.
Yeah, and that's exactly what you said, is like the audience, we are the patsy with Joe Frady. We're there doing what you do. You adopt the actions. You're the intuitive detective investigator in this thing. And you feel like you're in front of this whole movie. And then you sit down and you take the test to be a patsy. And when the test ends, you're ripe. you are ripe yourself. And every time I watch it, I was so honored. There's a great Australian boutique Blu-ray label named Imprint Films. And they knew I'd had such a relationship with Alan Pakula because of All the President's Minutes, our podcast. And I got asked to do a commentary track, and I was very, very blessed. And when it came to this sequence in it, I actually say on the commentary track, to paraphrase myself, I say something like, it feels criminal that I'm about to start talking over what I consider to be one of the greatest scenes that has ever been put to film. I don't know how much I'm going to have to say moment to moment, sequence to sequence. I'm just going to try and describe how this has this, I don't know, a constant impenetrable feeling, and how magnificent it is that you can go back to a movie, I don't know, 50 times in the last 50 years at this point, and still feel different things and still see different things and watch the way the cuts harmonize differently for you and what you focus on or fixate on at any given time. And every time you end in a greater state of being ripe for the ending of this movie.
I also think that, you know, speaking only for myself, I don't know that I have ever in my entire history of a moviegoer felt myself burrowing into the mind of a main character as deeply as I did while I was watching this sequence. Because as you're watching this sequence, you're not just thinking, what is this?
Yes.
What is the purpose of this? What is the function of this? What are these images? Why are they showing them to me? Why were they selected? Why are they arranged in this way? And you know, if you know even a little bit about film, you're thinking about, you know, the idea of editing, of montage editing, of juxtaposition, of what, you know, what they call dialectical editing. You know, the juxtaposition of like, thesis and antithesis, creating synthesis, as they say. And you know, so you're thinking about all this stuff, but you're also thinking, I am Joe Frady. I am sitting in this chair. They are showing this to me. My goal is to get recruited to be an assassin. Therefore, if they can feel my, you know, body reactions as I'm watching this stuff, like if I am Joe, how am I making myself react to these things? Am I fast enough to fool them? Am I convincing enough to fool them? It's kind of like being, it's almost like being an actor in a way.
Yes.
And you know, it's just, it's so deep, it's so rich. Like there's an entire other movie going on in this, you know, 4+ minutes. And that music, you know, Michael Small's score is another thing that I think we should talk about. I think it's one of the great scores in the entire history of the movies. Again, like everything about this movie is the best. And his score is so great. And just, and it's something so surprising and almost perverse about the music that plays in that sequence. Yeah, and I'm thinking about, like, I'm looking at these images of family, of, like, mother and father and me, and it's so innocent. It's so kind of Republican convention 1972, kind
yes.
of.
Yes.
It's corny. It's Life magazine. It's television in the 1950s. It's Norman Rockwell.
Yes.
You know, iconography, the Statue of Liberty, God, you know, churches, little girl praying, a pope. And then it says enemy and you see the Nazis, and the Nazis are going to show up later and apparently maybe not the enemy anymore. And happiness, unironically, you know, red meat, naked woman, an expensive car. And, you know, and then we see father again, and now we're seeing like the grapes of wrath and the depression and, you know, mother, like these haggard kind of Margaret Bourke White depression era photos. And like, there's a naked woman sitting on a bench. Like she seems like a prisoner, children living in squalor. And then happiness, the idea of happiness, it almost starts to move too quickly to catch up to, but it says me. And that's the second time you see me, and you see a boy, a little boy with a dirty face all by himself. And it really starts to scramble things up. And like, it's happening so fast. It's the speed of this montage that I think is part of what's so brilliant about it, is it happens so quickly that you can't process a rational thought or a coherent intellectualized opinion about what you're supposed to be looking at, of like, what is the purpose?
And yes.
And that's the way that authoritarians and con artists and high-pressure salespeople deal with others. They speak loudly, they speak decisively, and they speak so quickly that you can't process what they're saying. You have to kind of respond to the rhythm of their words viscerally, emotionally, not so much intellectually or rationally. And so it finds this visual language for the way that propaganda is written and the way that propaganda is spoken. And also just the reshuffling and the juxtaposition and rearrangement of the images is very much like those employee tests. Like whenever you apply for a job now, they give you a test, and it's like, and they'll ask you the same.
It's a weird psychometric test over and over again. It does feel like the parallax view. You're like, didn't I answer this question 6 times in like,
exactly.
It's weird.
Exactly. And it's like they'll ask you the same question six different ways and slightly different, and they'll word it slightly differently. So you're like, is that the same question? I don't know. Yeah.
It's...
And this triumphant music, it becomes more triumphant as it goes along. So it's almost like martial, you know,
yes.
M-A-R-T-I-A-L.
Yes.
In feeling. Where you're ready, like you're hyped up, you're ready to go off to war and, you know, kill some people for whoever tells you to, like, or maybe not.
Yes.
Or maybe not, you know, maybe the purpose of this test is to separate the patsies from the assassins. Like maybe an assassin would look at this and feel nothing in particular. Because if you're looking to recruit an assassin, you probably want somebody who's going to be completely cool, unflappable under pressure, not be influenced by anything, not have any particular feelings or opinions on anything.
And yet the entire time you're seeing this convergence of power, both good and evil in this sort of traditional archetypal sense, sex, you're looking at like it's the swelling thing is that like it's this egomaniacal thing in some ways as well, because it's like putting all this images of like the me stuff, the accomplishment is sex and power and these countries dominating, and then it's sort of now it's sort of slowly going into happiness and concluding, and then the light comes back up and here we are.
Yep. And you're ready to go fill out the paperwork.
My next psychometric test, I'm going to demand it's in a dark room and a light comes down. I don't want any of these questions unless it's in a montage.
There's also another piece of music that I wanted to talk about, if it's okay, which is that main theme. That I'll main theme that plays over and over.
Oh.
Yeah, it's great. It's great. This podcast could just be an hour of us listening to the Michael Small music and going, that's awesome.
just that delicate, inquisitive kind of double tap.
That is like an idea.
Exactly. But it's a bad idea. Or it's a malevolent idea.
Or it's a realization that is of no use.
The darkest realization. It's like, a realization that's too late.
Yes. Yes. And then here comes the part that takes it to the next level. Is when it shifts, it brings in a major key.
Yes.
With, I believe, woodwinds.
Oh, man.
And here it comes, I think.
Yes.
There's hope. There's hope. We can figure it out.
And then
we can get to the bottom of this mystery, Blake, you and me.
And then underneath, there's just still this.
But underneath, it's the same fucking dirge, man. It's the same, like, you know what's really going to happen. Everybody knows the dice are loaded, Blake.
Oh, God.
And it's that false hope. That hopeful part is it's false hopeful.
Yes.
And in a way, like, this piece of music captures for me better than any other piece of soundtrack music I've ever heard, the feeling of being horribly depressed. To me, this is the music that is the score for the 1970s in America and perhaps most of the world. Is, you know, that patriotism, the iconography that is so in theory uplifting and reassuring, and we're all in this together and there's nothing that some good old-fashioned elbow grease and ingenuity can't solve. But underneath it all, there's this like depressed slow heartbeat of like the dream ebbing away underneath it.
And there is something so magnificent in his orchestration, because I feel like, as we've just heard, the woodwinds almost feel like they're running out of air.
Yes.
There's something about that sequence where the people who are blowing on the instruments, he's almost like, I want you to deflate your lungs. I don't want you to be precise by the end of this. I want you to feel like you're exhausted. Like as you're playing the end of the triumph, you are tired and you're no longer gasping in huge breaths of air to to keep blasting at that same frequency, I want you to just
they're in the studio, and like Pakul is there behind the glass, and they get done with the take, and like, what did you think? He's like, can you do it again, but this time more deflated and sad?
It really is
amazing.
If you could all just run around the block three times and then come back and try and do that, that would be much appreciated.
Yes. And you know, it's remarkable to me, you know, this movie apparently was kind of slapped together.
Yes.
It was kind of slapped together, and I think you know all the details of it, but it was a lot was changed. They were kind of changing things as they were shooting it. There were enormous decisions being made and remade at the last possible minute. It's kind of a miracle that it's even watchable. And yet, you know, maybe that feeling of being under the gun of having to, you know, make the big, simple decisions might have contributed something positive to it. I don't know.
And I think also when you've got someone like Beatty and Pakula, especially what he wanted, like these are great filmmaking minds. And I feel like, you know, that's what they always talk about. Like when you're making a film on set and you're a director, and especially a writer director, or a producer director as well, you're there just to problem solve, to execute on what they've got to do. And because they're working and reworking these things, I think the instincts and the levels of all the people that you're talking about, like this whole crew of collaborators, you know, Beatty and Pakula and Gordon Willis, and they're making these decisions, and then they can kind of like, they're figuring it out and piecing the puzzle together, but it's like the best group of problem solvers possible to make that happen. It's and also being able to make this thing that's both inside Hollywood and directly outside and counter to it. I think that's what I keep seeing in this. I'm like, oh, their instincts here, just like pure sort of like psychological instincts of the story that they want to tell, just that just shows me how good they are, like, and how good Pakula is and how undervalued he is, I feel like, as a filmmaker.
There's this piece in the Los Angeles Review of Books that was published in 2014 by John Boorstin, who was an assistant to Gordon Willis on The Parallax View. And there was a lot of great material in here, including, you know, of course, which we all know, Gordon Willis's affinity for chiaroscuro, and particularly as demonstrated by Rembrandt. But also the minimalism and the precision and the kind of parameters that he set up, and just the way that he shot things. He was very, very into what is my lens, what is the height of the camera, how much light am I using, and then he would never deviate. And that's part of what makes his movies so distinctive to look at. And there was one part of it which I thought was kind of really revealing, which is he says the style had an added advantage. No one could screw with it. There was no latitude, as they say. Gordon despised latitude. Gordon told me this, but I saw for myself. After shooting, I stayed on with Pakula, and one of my jobs was supervising the final color correction of the Parallax View's answer print. That was the highest quality available then, or perhaps ever, Technicolor three-strip printing. And he goes on to say, you had to print it just like Gordon saw it in his head. Nowadays, a cinematographer can go and tweak the light on a person's cheekbone. But back then, you were stuck with the whole frame. And in Gordon's case, stuck with a way of printing it. And then he goes on to talk about the scene where the guy comes to evaluate Joe Frady, the guy from the Parallax Corporation.
Yeah.
And he says, Beatty knew this was his moment. He was a renowned perfectionist. And as Pakula had, as Gordon put it, an iron ass. He liked to say film is cheap. Pakula pushed him, and Beatty pushed himself again and again. In those days, there was no video playback. You couldn't see the scene until it came back as dailies. They both knew when they finally got it right. That was, I'd say, the creative high point for both of them. The scene took place in Beatty's seedy DOS house, lit by a single overhead bulb. He is hunched over, muttering his confessional, face in shadow. Gordon used his whisper of fill light. Dailies came back the next day with Beatty's face solid black, nothing there, but we had moved on. That was it. Gordon told me that he'd done it on purpose to protect Pakula and Beatty because he didn't think Beatty could pull off the moment. I wasn't present when the three of them held their very private meeting. I remember a shaken Gordon afterwards. Later, I'd learned that it was as close as Gordon ever came to being fired. Also, that he'd admitted he'd blown it and felt terrible about it. But here's the thing. That was the right decision.
Yeah.
Because by putting Beatty's face almost entirely in shadow during that sequence, it denies us the ability to make our own informed decision about whether or not his performance, such as it is convincing. Beatty's performance as Joe Frady and Joe Frady's performance for the benefit of this recruiter. We're denied that information, just as we're denied the information that we want during that montage sequence, which is, you know, what are we looking at? Why are they showing us this? Why is it in this order? What effect is it supposed to produce? What information are they trying to get from me, et cetera? Like, that denial of information, denial of the answers that you want, is the essence of the paranoid thriller. And the fact that the denial of certainty, the denial of data, the denial of facts is baked into every single creative decision they made on the Parallax View is the reason why it is the greatest of all paranoid thrillers.
Yes. It's, I just love so much that he was protecting, like he felt like it was protecting the integrity of the movie and the integrity, yeah. I mean, for any creative decision, if you're protecting the integrity of the thing that you're making, I don't think it can be bad. I think it can be different than what people expect and probably why they had to have a very, you know, heated probably exchange. But man alive, I wouldn't change a frame of this movie for the world. There's no Snyder cut that's coming out of the Parallax View. I want the uninhibited, perfect, seamless cut. And exactly as they said, as John Burson, who I got to speak to, a great guy, in our president's journey, that seamlessness allows for all of the things that we mentioned earlier in the conversation, which is these weird generic detours, you know, '50s cowboy bar fights and car chases and things, because it is just seamless. The idea is just cohesive because stylistically it all connects. And so it doesn't ever feel like you're taking these weird detours. It keeps you on rails with the increasing paranoia. And I think exactly as you said, it's like and how much more do you find yourself? And I know this is probably the case for both you and I. How much more do you find yourself leaning in, getting closer and closer to the screen every time in that scene, just to try and capture anything else from Beatty? I think that's a magic trick in and of itself.
Well, I would even go further and say that I now believe, after God only knows how many viewings of this movie, I don't believe that those sort of traditional 70s movie action, you know, wise ass action hero set pieces, I don't feel like they're detours. I feel like they're in a way undermining those cliches and sort of making you aware of the absurdity of them. And I feel like, taken together with everything else that the movie is doing, like those elements are saying, like, this is bread and circuses, these Hollywood movies.
Yes.
These fantasies that we're being fed, where one person can make a difference and get to the bottom of it and expose the truth and save the world. These are the lies that we're fed. You know, it doesn't work this way. And it certainly doesn't work this way, you know, where it's the lone wolf hero who doesn't play by the rules. Like, that's BS. Like, that's, yes, that's like another tool of the bad guys, is that they make us believe that this stuff is true. And, you know, I feel like it's all of a piece. It's all of a piece in this movie. And, you know, whatever they were doing, and it's clear that they were, you know, working very intuitively a lot of the time. The result is just perfect.
Yeah, such a special movie. I'm so glad. And firstly, I'm so grateful for your time. Secondly, I'm so glad and in the best possible way jealous of the Saturday, June 29th, 3 p.m. audience at the Texas Theater with the introduction from yourself and a great conversation with you and filmmaker Sam Esmail, the man behind Mr. Robot and Leave the World Behind. Some folks are going to hear a little tiny snippet of that just as a tease at the beginning of this conversation that'll prime you for this. But Matt, look, thank you so much again. It's always a treat and a pleasure to talk to you. And just, yeah, thank you so much for being a part of everything we do here. It's just, you know.
Blake, I appreciate it. I appreciate everything you do. And there's only one thing I want to add and as we segue out of this, which is, the Texas Theater is a theater where they captured Lee Harvey Oswald.
Oh, Matt. Oh, what a sometimes history speaks to us, doesn't it? Isn't it fun when history and art, they speak to us, and there's just a confluence of events that happens, and you're like, this couldn't be it. There's not a better spot in the world. There's, you know, it's like I wouldn't count myself as like a necessarily superstitious person or necessarily a religious person in the traditional sense, but man alive, some spaces, they hold memory. There's something that happens, and I think that the Parallax View in the Texas Theater, there's a frequency that piece of art and that space holds in history. It's oh man alive, what, talk about it. Yeah, talk about a theater for patsies. Talk about a theater for patsies.
I'm almost thinking maybe I shouldn't show up.
Well, I'm going to be so glad that you do show up, and I think a whole bunch of people are going to show up and enjoy this stunning piece of cinema on a beautiful screen. And whatever weird feelings that conjures up, the actual parallax scene, the montage scene we broke down together in that theater, oh, that sounds like a pretty special experience. So for everyone who's going to be there, enjoy it. And thank you so much again for coming out. This is a special movie. I'm glad I've only spoken to a few folks about it, but I'm really glad that when an anniversary pops around, I've got another excuse to talk about it, just like you're doing with this screening. So thank you.
Thank you, Blake.